Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this month, the two largest newspaper companies in the United States announced they were merging. Gatehouse Media, through its parent company New Media Investment Group, is acquiring Gannett Co. for $1.4 billion. The combined company will go by the Gannett name, and it will control hundreds of newspapers across the country, including the Burlington Free Press, which has been owned by Gannett since 1971. In a few minutes, we're going to look at the Vermont news and media landscape and how all of the recent changes, including this one, are affecting what kind of information you get about your state and your communities. But first, let's get context for this big newspaper change and what it means nationwide. David Folkenflik is the media correspondent for National Public Radio. He's also the Friday host of NPR's On Point. He's been covering the Gatehouse-Gannett merger, and he joins us now from NPR Studios in New York. David, thank you so much for making time for us.
Hey, Jane. Pleasure.
Can you explain what Gannett and Gatehouse are and how many papers each controls, what they bring to the table with this merger?
About a gazillion. Gannett, if I'm remembering correctly, owns about 109 newspapers. Gatehouse owns over 160, but that doesn't even include the 600-plus weekly newspapers across the country. So, you know, Gannett has some pretty good size. You know, one of the things Gannett doesn't have is major newspapers in major metro markets like New York, Philadelphia, Boston, things like that. It owns, obviously, USA Today. Gannett also owns big papers in large cities like Detroit, Des Moines, you know, some really important Indianapolis, some important players. Gatehouse tends to be on the smaller scale. They own a couple of papers in decent-sized cities like Austin and Palm Beach, Columbus, Akron, up in Ohio. But by and large, they tend to have smaller market things. And Gannett, you know, Gannett these days is seen as a reputable, important newspaper company. Back when I was starting in the early 90s, you know, people really recognized it as a place with a relentless focus on the bottom line, looking to prop up profits to closer what local news, television stations enjoyed than what newspapers had enjoyed. But you got to remember in the 80s and even much of the 90s, profits, double-digit profits were seen as almost a birthright of newspapers. They were fat with classified ads, national ads, and the like. And that all went away with the digital revolution. Gatehouse is owned so Gannett has just been cutting. Gatehouse is owned by a New York-based investment company. Fortress really controls it. And Fortress itself was acquired by a Japanese investment conglomerate called SoftBank. So you're talking about an incredible constellation of newspapers all across the country, particularly away from New York, Washington, Los Angeles, and some of the other largest major markets that are going to be combined and essentially ultimately owned by a foreign investment group. It doesn't seem as though SoftBank, the ultimate owner, has exercised any editorial influence whatsoever. But it is worth knowing that these are, you know, part of the engines that I think put it another way, this is the heart that drives the bloodstream of democracy and our understanding of what happens in communities around us to the extent that they still have bodies in those newsrooms to cover our lives and our events. And, you know, this is going to be controlled by a single company, a company at that is owned abroad.
You know, you mentioned the reputation of Gannett and how it has changed over the years. And I'm, you know, part of me is also wondering, has the reputation changed because Gannett changed and is more respected in the news business? Or has the reputation changed because so many other even more cutthroat companies came in, or others, not so many others, but a few others? But when it comes to Gatehouse, you know, that is not so well known, at least by name, and certainly here in Vermont. And from what I hear, their reputation worries some people about what's going to happen to the newspapers they're acquiring from Gannett, and to that question of gutting, that there may be more gutting that goes on.
Yeah, there's no question but that Gannett has been cutting and in some cases gutting their papers quite significantly with cutbacks. And let me just say, some of their newsrooms have still produced dynamite coverage nonetheless. You think of the Indianapolis Star's coverage, particularly I believe of it was gymnastics coaches who had been for years abusing some of the girls and very young women who had been in their charge. In Detroit, you know, there's incredible bird dogging and watchdogging of, for example, the way in which the University of Michigan system invests its money and benefits pals of the various, you know, state and university officials. These are papers that have done some really wonderful work, but that's not because of the ownership structure. That's because of the journalists who care about what they're doing. I think Gannett has won respect because they've tried to hold the line on cutting to the point where that kind of journalism is no longer possible. And I think there are people inside the company that care about it. You know, I talked with Steve Call. He's the former managing editor of The Washington Post, and he's also a corporate director of Gannett. And he said he voted for this because Gannett was running out of landing space, that is, or running room, put it that way. That is that there was a worry that the decline in certain kinds of print revenues not only was it not being made up for in digital growth and revenues, but that there was decreasing room to let that play out and try to figure out solutions. And they clearly didn't have the solution for that. You know, they created what was called the USA Today Network, which was a way of sort of standardizing some of their national coverage and pooling some of their regional coverage to see if there were both reports worth sharing on a national level and also reports that might dovetail with the kinds of reporting on related topics being done in other newsrooms. I think there's been some good insights from that, but it's not like it's solving their bottom line issues involving tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, and so Gannett needed this lifeline to be able to get through it.
Well, so and they have this lifeline, and they're expecting to have some efficiencies, certainly in the way that all of these papers can be run. And if you think about, you know, efficiencies of not having two large structures but one structure. But in terms of that question of increasing revenues through advertising and finding ways to get people to buy the paper more, whether it's subscribing online or getting a print subscription, is there reason to believe that under this merger, this new company called Gannett, but acquired by Gatehouse, will be able to take that, you know, landing strip and find a way at the end to increase the revenues? I mean, is there actually hope for that?
I think there's assertion of that. I think that's a different thing from thinking that's completely credible. But, you know, certainly the people doing it, while executives tend to enrich themselves in such deals on both sides, so they may have an incentive for that reason, which shouldn't be forgotten. I think that the folks at Fortress and SoftBank think that's likely. I think the real question is, can you do that and still sustain anything recognizable as accountability journalism in all these communities, hundreds of communities around the country, some of which are already served by very small newsrooms, much diminished newsrooms. Gatehouse and Gannett have promised that they can do this and it will make sense and they will achieve a savings annually of $275 million to $300 million a year to make it possible to do this with their debt that they'll take on to do this, and that those cuts won't be one-time cuts, but that the cost basis will be lowered by, you know, again, $300 million a year from what it currently is throughout the combined chain. I think that suggests some very significant costs. You can't just do that by saying, look, we'll take all the accounting and merge it and, you know, diminish the size of the market, right? Mm-hmm. And yes, they will be able to standardize some software and things like that and make it possible to, you know, essentially lay off some people in the non-journalistic elements, which isn't great for them either. But, you know, I think that I asked Steve Call, I said, are you confident this is going to do? He says, no, but, you know, I believe it's the best shot we have.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of seems like no, but what's the alternative?
I think Gannett felt it had run out of answers. You know, listen, the Washington Post, the storied Graham Weymouth family had run that since the 30s and had done it with great distinction and really elevated what the Washington Post was. And yet the Graham families, you know, which had been so important on Watergate, the Pentagon Papers, the Trump era, the Clinton years, whatever, they had run out of answers too. They turned to Jeff Bezos, who's turned out to be a big pocketed but also quite emotionally invested guy who's given them a ton of money and time to figure this out and lift their journalism. I don't think anybody expects that kind of investment or that kind of conviction here.
David, is there any worry about a monopoly now with the two largest newspaper companies merging, or is that not a concern?
I think the great concern, you know, I think we're served by having a multiplicity of voices, and I think we're served by having a multiplicity of journalistic approaches throughout the country and in, you know, specific communities. These two organizations don't really overlap. So in terms of geographic monopoly, you're not seeing anything more or less that way than there was really before, except to the extent that there may be. Well, Gannett had spun off its television stations. So even though the Tegna company, as the TV company is now branded, is no longer part of Gannett, you could argue else if they're now merging, so there may be some markets in which you have these former Gannett TV stations and papers. I don't think that's as big a concern. I do think that in any rational world, you know, a single company owning that many hundreds of newspapers around the country suggests a homogenization, and that that is a concern. But I don't think you're going to see a particularly strong regulatory break being put on this. The Trump administration gave its blessing essentially to Disney taking over almost all of Fox's entertainment products, even though Disney was already a huge behemoth. Disney is now going to be enormous. It made the case it needed this to be able to compete with Amazon and Netflix and now Apple in the entertainment sphere. But also the administration sought to block the AT&T takeover of what was Time Warner and lost badly, like embarrassingly, in federal court. And while some of that opposition may have been ideological because of the president's criticism of CNN, which was part of Time Warner, is now part of AT&T, those two elements didn't directly compete, AT&T and Time Warner. And so they said this really needs to be allowed to proceed. And I think that they're just going to let it happen. I don't think there's a strong desire to block it. But I do think it's a concern for monopolization, which really is homogenization. And I think it also means that it tends to diminish the competitive spirit of journalists and tends to diminish any kind of pressure on ownership to stave off deeper cuts in newsrooms if they don't have other news organizations embarrassing them by doing good work.
David Folkenflik is media correspondent for NPR. He's also the Friday host of NPR's On Point. David, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Since this merger we've just been talking about could have a significant effect on the Burlington Free Press, we wanted to talk to someone intimately involved in the content that goes into the paper to see what the changes might bring and what the news staff is thinking about. Emily Stigliani is executive editor of the Burlington Free Press, and she's on the line with us now. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
So can you talk about any changes that you have been made aware of that are likely coming down the pike? And we're thinking here like layoffs, retirement offers, changes to what you put out in the paper that would affect the editorial direction of the Free Press?
So I really can't speak specifics in terms of anything about the merger, but I can say that, you know, up until the announcement, we had 14 positions in our newsroom, and we still have 14 positions. We're actually two of which are open, and so we are currently hiring. So if anyone out there is a badass journalist who wants to come work with me and my team, I invite them to apply.
So you have 14 positions now. You had 14 positions before August 5th, but of course the merger hasn't gone through. And there are a lot of people who look at what this merger might mean and at the way Gatehouse has operated, which will now own the company, and who worry about the future of these local newspapers. What's your feeling when you think about the fact that this merger is coming and it's going to affect the paper one way or another?
So I can't really speak to feelings about the merger given my position. I'm sure you can understand, but I can give you a general sense of my feelings about leadership and the awesome responsibility that I've given to lead this very long-standing legacy newsroom. I think that it's really important to see opportunity in change and to not make assumptions, not jump to conclusions, and to be open to seeing what potential is out there.
Can you not speak to the merger because you worry about the safety of your position or because of the position you hold and what you think of as obligations to your parent company?
So I am obviously, I'm not authorized to speak about the merger. That's not my purview. My purview is the news content. There's other people at the company who are more closely involved. I know what you guys know in terms of what is reported by other media, and mostly I'm just focused on leading our team and leading our team in creating coverage that speaks to the readers' needs.
How do you see the role of the Burlington Free Press in Vermont's news media landscape and in what you want to be the paper of record on, what you think you can be the paper of record on, given the staffing challenges that the Free Press has had over the years?
So that's a really good question. I think of the newspaper, more than I think of it as a paper of record, I think of it as the piece of civic content that I would like to be accessible and available to a broad swath of people so that they can all be reading something and kind of having the same facts come to bear on what they're discussing. I know that when I was studying in journalism school, I was sort of captivated by this idea that, a general interest newspaper should be written for a fourth grade reading level. It should be digestible. It should be understandable. It should explain issues. And so I really think about that often in guiding the coverage of our paper, our news site.
And when you say everybody should have this sort of basis of understanding about their communities, because the Free Press can be there for people to all read these stories, to all understand what's happening in their communities, with a staff of 14 and a charge to be, you know, not just a paper for Burlington, how can you do that? How are people going to be aware of their communities? You know, do you have to focus on certain beats, or do you say, you know, you're not going to find out what's happening to your select board because we don't have enough reporters to go there?
That's a really good question. So it takes a lot of discernment, and it's an imperfect process, but it is one where we spend a lot of time listening to readers, looking. We're particularly interested. We see the need to innovate and reach digital readers. So understanding what are the concerns of our digital audience and trying to bring facts and information to bear on those concerns. So it's a little bit more of a ground-up approach than top-down. Often the result can be the same because you can go to the select board meeting and then do shoe leather reporting to find out the implications of any decision. But you can also listen to what people are saying and then sort of track the issue to the top.
Can you point to an example of a story or content that you're really proud of that illuminates what you're talking about there?
Yeah. So what's coming to mind off the top of my head is, I think this does speak to what I'm talking about. It's actually, if you go to our website right now, you'll see that our main story is a piece in which we, April McCullum, one of our newest digital innovation editor, longtime reporter for us, actually went to Kansas and explored what a community was doing after their school closed, what they were doing with that building, how they were preserving civic ties. And we actually got partnered with the Solutions Journalism Network this summer in order to undertake this project, because we really wanted to explore with Vermonters, for Vermonters, what these sorts of pressures on school consolidation might look like and how to approach the conversation, leaning into the facts and also looking for solutions to preserve some of what might be lost in some communities.
Emily Stigliani is executive editor of the Burlington Free Press. Emily, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about the merger and about what the Free Press does.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking about the merger of the country's two largest newspaper companies and how it's likely to affect the Burlington Free Press, which is owned by Gannett. It's now merging with Gatehouse Media. This change is coming within the context of an ongoing news and media upheaval, as traditional ways that people get their news have struggled to keep pace with the new media landscape. So let's talk a little bit about what's happening throughout Vermont when it comes to news coverage and who's doing it. And joining us now for this discussion are Tracy Griffith, Associate Professor at St. Michael's College in the Department of Media Studies, Journalism, and Digital Arts. Tracy's a former Associated Press correspondent and editor, and she also served for a time on the VPR Board of Directors. Tracy, a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Candace Page spent 30 years reporting and working for the Burlington Free Press, including a stint as the paper's managing editor. And because newspaper people have a really hard time retiring, Candy's now a consulting editor at 7 Days. It's a pleasure to have you back, Candy. Nice to talk
with
you again.
It's great to see you again, Jane.
And Paul Heinz is a staff writer and political editor for the Vermont Weekly 7 Days. His reporting on the sale or planned sale of 20 media outlets in the last 3 years in Vermont was part of the paper's media issue earlier this month. Paul, it's nice to have you with us today as well.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to David Folkenflik talk about what this big change or big merger could mean for newspapers around the country. The two largest newspaper companies merging means that there is this consolidation, at least David Folkenflik described it as perhaps a homogenization of the news. And Emily Stigliani saying, you know, we haven't gotten any directives for the free press, but I think it's safe to say that a lot of people are concerned at the very least about what this might mean for the Burlington Free Press and for newspapers in general. So thinking about newspapers specifically first and what this merger might mean. Candy, I'm curious about your reaction and thoughts.
Well, I'd say it's highly unlikely that Gatehouse is going to come in and say, okay, let's hire five more reporters for the Free Press.
Here's a lot more money.
Yeah, here's a bunch of money. Go do your job. I was really struck by when Emily said that she has a staff of 14 in the newsroom. I was managing editor of the Free Press in the very late 90s, and 62 people reported to me. So that really says it all about what the Free Press is able to do. I want to be sure I say I left friends behind at the Free Press, good journalists who try every day to do a great job, I know. But you cannot cover even a small city responsibly with 14 people.
So does that mean that, you know, whether it's owned by Gannett or whether it's owned by Gatehouse and still called Gannett, it's a paper that that, like many newspapers around the country, is diminished and is unlikely to get back to its former glory? Certainly a staff of 60 people is unlikely.
Well, print newspapers have not figured out a way back, and I don't think that's going to happen. I think print journalism in general, that these small local papers are going to go away. I mean,
Do you think the small local papers are
Well,
going to?
I think small local dailies, I should say that. You know, part of the vacuum that the Free Press has left has been filled by somewhat more professional local weeklies in Chittenden County. You know, the Shelburne News, the other paper now, you know, are trying to cover their communities the way journalists do. But I don't, you know, you can compare what's happened at the Free Press to what's happened at the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus, locally owned by a family that cared deeply about journalism, weren't able to do any better a job at survival than the Free Press has done. So part of this is, as David said, is the digital revolution. And you know, that's why maybe the future is Vermont Digger and various versions of that around the country. I don't know. I'm sure Paul and Tracy have some thoughts.
Yeah. And Tracy, let me come to you first because, you know, just because a traditional media outlet like a newspaper, which, you know, also we should say it certainly is going digital, but just because that doesn't have the news staff and the robust reporting capacity that it had 20 or 30 years ago doesn't mean that the state is not served by great journalism. There are a lot of other outlets like Digger that could come in and sort of fill that gap. But are they? I mean, do we have a diminished ability to know what's going on in our communities in Vermont now than we did 20 years ago?
We absolutely do. The problem, as Candy talked about, is that we simply just don't have the bodies, right? I mean,
Vermont, so nobody is coming in to fill that gap fully.
Fully. I mean, I think there are – journalism is not dying. Journalism is evolving, right? Things are changing. The way people access information is changing. And so we're seeing this kind of revolution that's happening within the media industry. And there are some media outlets that are kind of picking up the slack and trying to do the job of traditional journalism in a new way. And it's working for some. Digger as an example, but there aren't enough, right? There just simply aren't enough. And if we're hoping that we can get back to that place, that sweet spot where we have 60 people, right, in one news organization covering the state, we have a long way to go to get back to that.
Paul Hines, I realize that this is for you and I especially. This is kind of not a tricky show to do, but it really affects how we think about our jobs, our careers, and the organizations that you and I work for on a daily basis trying to do this work. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with all that's been said. And I think that one question I have is what happens to the very local journalism? Because I think that we've got a couple of news outlets who've done a pretty good job of trying to fill the void in statewide news coverage and in state house news coverage. We've mentioned Digger, which is a great example, but also VPR, I think, is a really good example. And 7 Days is certainly trying to do the same. But one thing that I think none of those three news organizations can do terribly well is be the paper of record for a smaller city in Vermont or a larger town in Vermont that it, back in the day, may have had somebody or probably did have somebody who attended every select board meeting, every school board meeting, and really kept an eye on what was going on there. And I do think that both Digger and VPR have tried to invest in regional reporters, often covering a county or a particular part of the state, and trying to get to those more local stories. But they're still appealing to a more statewide audience. And so I fear that our local governments are not getting the scrutiny that they need in order to be good local governments.
But couldn't the future of journalism be then, you know, maybe there are fewer and even fewer reporters in a big statewide or regional news organization, but the really hyper-local seems to be where there's a future in some ways for journalism, because that's where people can't get their news from another source. You know, if you have, in my community, I'm Addison County, we have the Addison Independent. It comes out twice a week in the print version. You know, it's not a daily, but it has the ability to say, we're covering stories that VPR isn't going to cover, 7 Days isn't going to cover, Digger isn't going to cover. And, you know, so far at least seems to be doing pretty well.
And I think that's a great point. And I would say that there are some really great examples throughout the state where you still have very solid local journalism, and Addison County is definitely one of those because of the Independent. That, you know, that is owned by a person who lives locally, who's invested a lot of time and energy over the years in making sure that's a good paper. You know, there are other examples. The Herald Randolph, I think, is a really good example because it's such a small area they cover, but boy, do they do a great job. So I don't want to say that that's not happening. I just worry that there are a lot of pockets where it's not happening, or it's you just don't have the number of people working there as you once did.
Candy Page does something like Front Porch Forum take up a little bit of that slack. It's certainly not journalism, but it is a community forum for people to be able to get information about what's happening in their town.
Well, I love Front Porch Forum, and as somebody who is now disposing of many possessions through Front Porch Forum, I really appreciate it. But it is not journalism. That is – and that's the point. So on Front Porch Forum, I can read what my city councilor says happened at the city council meeting and what it means. But I want an impartial observer who – will go beyond what my city councilor has to say. And that's what Burlington lacks. In fact, my guess is that there are now small towns in Vermont, like Middlebury, where people can more easily learn what's going on in their city government than in the city of Burlington, because the free press is not able to do the kind of municipal journalism it used to.
At JGC O Canada, we got a tweet that says, watch out for this kind of lazy journalistic maneuver with Gatehouse Media. And they tweeted then a front page news story from the North Carolina Sun Journal, where a lead story on local crime had given the byline to the county sheriff's office. And let's go to Scott, who's calling in from St. Hippolyte in Quebec. Hi, Scott. Go right ahead.
Howdy, ma'am. My comment was based on media bias. I mean, within the past 10 years, the culture within media, I think, it's unfortunately there's lots have to do with Bing words and trying to get people to go towards that specific media outlet. But wherein lies true non-biased information that can be given? I mean, regardless of who's reporting on it, you're always going to have an inherent bias. Maybe you lean this way or you lean that way. it's becoming more difficult to actually get true unbiased information in news outlets that are out there today.
Scott, do you believe that to be true about news outlets that purport to be pretty straightforward, or is it more about what consumers are gravitating toward? Because it's hard when consumers say, I'm going to read the story that aligns with my particular political belief, because there are so many choices that they have. So is it about consumers, or is it about reporters and newsmakers, news reporters?
Well, I mean, newsmakers and news reporters, obviously, they want to produce something that sells, correct? So, like, they're going to gravitate towards something that, you know, strikes an impulse in somebody wanting to read that paper or wanting to click to that channel because it aligns with their, you know, maybe political affiliation or even socioeconomic situation that they're in, you know. What I think that does is it takes away from the impartialness of what media needs to be. I don't think that the excuse me.
Bless you.
I don't think that all this, you know, there's a lot of name pointing and finger pointing and stuff like that when you turn on, you know, any news channel now, and it's a little bit distressing to see that. You know, instead of talking about all the bad stuff that happens, which is news, you know, and I understand that. I'd like to know about, you know, 5-year-old Maggie Mae down the road that opened up a lemonade stand or something like that. I mean, it's anecdotal. Yes, I know, but.
Yeah, Scott, I hear what you're saying, and I want to we're going to take a 1-minute break, and then I'm going to come back. And Tracy Griffith, I really want to get your perspective on this, because there are competing interests and competing ways that we can think about this, whether it's the news consumer, the people who are saying, yeah, I'm, you know, not going to do that. I don't care about that news. I don't want your deep analysis of the city council meeting. I want to see that really red meat story that's going to make me angry, versus what are actual reporters and news organizations and the companies that own the news organizations and are helping to dictate what is being reported actually doing in terms of bias. So we were hearing from Scott earlier about first what he was saying was a distressing bias that he's seeing in the news media. And Professor Griffith, I'd love to know your thoughts, your reflections on that.
Well, I think to the reader's point, it's really important that we have a variety of sources, because if you feel that there's bias in the media that you're consuming, the opportunity to discover and follow other news sources kind of brings it more towards center, right? So, but if those news sources aren't there because they've all been gobbled up by a conglomerate, you're hearing one biased perspective. And so that's why it's really, really important to have that variety.
And even if it's not a biased perspective, you're only maybe getting half the story because the reporter could only cover that one, or that's what they thought was the most important. It's not even always just a political bias.
Of course, of course. And the role of smaller publications, that's where Maggie Mae fits in, right? That's where you can have those kinds of hyper-local stories. But in order to kind of mitigate bias that you might feel is there, that's why we need the variety of sources. And having publications kind of being consumed by this one media conglomerate is dangerous because of that.
Are you worried about that?
I am.
Significantly worried?
I am.
Paul Hines?
Well, I'm also worried, but I was going to speak to a different point that the caller raised about the need to sell journalism, to sell stories, papers, whatever. And, you know, this is for many news organizations a commercial enterprise, not true of the nonprofits. But I do think it's important to think about the incentives that reporters and editors have. So at a lot of the corporate-owned media outlets, there's a real focus on how many clicks each story gets. And, you know, we've seen that at the Free Press over the years. They're highly focused, and it's, again, you know, not the fault of the journalists there, but the corporate mandates, they are very focused on getting clicks. And so that will prompt you to make different decisions about what you cover than if you're thinking about what the full news product is. I think at locally owned news organizations and at nonprofit news organizations, the real incentive is to build up the brand over time and to become a trusted news source so that people, you know, believe what you're doing. They want what you're doing. So there's less of an incentive for that short-term I guess, sugar rush of a story. And, you know, I heard a Free Press editor who's no longer there a couple years ago address a journalism gathering in Vermont, describing the process that they used at the time to figure out whether to cover, you know, this particular city council or that city council. And the answer was clicks, you know, how many people were reading those stories. And I don't think, you know, I see certainly at 7 days, the stories that I think are the most powerful, the most important, aren't clicked on by that many people, but they're still worth doing. They're essential to do. And if we just wanted to get eyeballs, we would just be writing about crime 24/7.
They're essential to do, but in a new media landscape where people have the choice whether to click on it or not, as opposed to the old school newspaper where you probably were going to at least read the headline, maybe read through the first few paragraphs because it was there and because you kind of had to if you're going through the paper, then maybe those stories, which may be important to do, you can't do them if really nobody is looking at them, then you can't, you know, there's no point.
That's a risk. But I think, I mean, just focusing on VPR and Vermont Digger, I think those organizations show the opposite, which is that when you do good journalism over time, people want to support it and people want to read it. So, yeah, it's going to be, your job's going to be tougher in the short term. But I think the long term, you build up trust and you build up a readership or a listenership base.
Candy Page.
Well, you know, we don't have the First Amendment to the Constitution so that we can cover Maggie May. And
poor Maggie May. She's getting a lot of...
and I love Maggie May and her...
Maggie May, if you missed the call, was our caller's theoretical child who's doing something really great in town and should get more coverage because right. It's a good news story.
Right. And I have to say... being an old fogey, back when newspapers were truly robust, there was plenty of room for accountability journalism and Maggie May. You could have it all in one package, and now you can't. But yes, you know, the first responsibility we always said of a newspaper was to stay in business. So I don't discount that. But it's not like owning a grocery store. You have a responsibility, a civic responsibility to shine a light on government. That's why we need newspapers. If they're not going to do that, then we can all go back to Front Porch Forum and that will be just plenty.
Well, and also Megan in Burlington emailed in to say, I want to make sure that CCTV is included in local governmental coverage. They tape most local meetings countywide. They're a gem in terms of unbiased gavel-to-gavel coverage. I guess the difference there is you're actually watching the meeting. You're not getting the analysis, which can be both good or not good, depending on what perspective you need and want. And maybe you need both.
Well, but... what journalists do is they go to the meeting so you don't have to, and they give you – before they give you the analysis, they tell you what happened so that – yes, I also appreciate CCTV and it's a great resource, but many people don't want to sit through the select board meeting, although they want to know what the select board decided.
Let's go to Meredith calling in from Essex Junction. Hi, Meredith.
Hi.
What are your thoughts? What's your perspective?
So I'm relatively young. I'm 19 years old, and so I'm just sort of getting into news and media and things like that. And I think a really important point to bring up is that I was never shown as a kid how to read a newspaper. I was never shown where to pick one up. I was never told in school that if I want a job, I need to go look in the help wanted section of a newspaper. I was told to Google it. I was told to seek out the larger groups instead of looking at my local sources. And I think it's really important to also remember that it's not being taught anymore. It's not being shown to kids that the newspaper is a very viable source for information and where they can go to find things like jobs or understand what's happening in their local government. Because I never was shown that. Like, I Google things on my phone. I'm 19. That's what I do.
Of course you do.
So,
Meredith, that's such an interesting perspective. And, yeah, such a generational shift. I really thank you for sharing that. Let's talk to Del, who's calling in from Worcester. Hi, Del.
Hi. And I have a story related to that. I've been addicted to reading a newspaper in my hand every day since I was a kid. I started out with the comic section, but I subscribe to the Barry Times Argus, and I was worried when they got bought out and so on, but they're still doing stuff. And 2 years ago, I decided to give my 13-year-old grandson a subscription to the Times Argus, and my daughter and her husband thought that was crazy, but he got into it. And what got him into it was the sports section. But they continue to get it. They all are reading it now, and he often goes online to read it, but that paper copy is there. I just want to encourage grandparents to consider this as a way of sort of helping a new generation tune into what's out there. And it is, I really appreciate the local coverage. There's a little bit of national and international. I don't need that from my paper newspaper, though. And the local stuff is really important. So
yeah, Del, I appreciate that and your encouragement to other grandparents to get their grandkids a subscription to the newspaper. Paul, you wanted to jump on that?
Yeah, I did. Well, I think that's it's an astute observation about what's been going on at the Times Argus. They have been, that paper, which is the sister paper of the Rutland Herald, was owned, as Candy said earlier on, by the same family for a couple of generations. Those papers have gone through not one but two ownership transitions in the last few years. One of the strategies that they are now pursuing is they've moved back from being very essentially statewide papers to being very local papers. So they have stopped trying to compete at the State House. They closed their State House bureau, and they are trying to redeploy their remaining reporters, far fewer reporters, it should be noted, but the ones they have, to covering Rutland County in the case of the Herald, and Washington County in the case of the Times Argus. So that's one strategy that I think some what you might call legacy news organizations are doing, because they can provide something that nobody else is doing.
I was on a panel recently with Maggie Cassidy from the Valley News, and she was saying that sports in many cases really are the gateway for people to get into that paper. You want to hear about what happened with your local sports team, your high school sports, the kids you know. That is a real good gateway still for people to get into their local newspaper. Let's go to Bill in Surrey, New Hampshire. Bill, hi.
Hello. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, I was a newspaper reporter, daily newspaper reporter in Western Massachusetts, running a newsroom of 14 full-time journalists covering one county of Western Massachusetts. We had two full-time people covering the city of Northampton, which is a population of about 24,000 at the time. So, you know, I don't think those days are coming back anytime soon, but there's definitely a dearth of actual local news. I don't think local newspapers are able to send people to a tenth of the meetings that we used to cover. And I used to hate covering meetings. You know, what newspaper reporter, you know, wakes up in the morning and says, oh, great, I get to go to the housing authority tonight. But, you know, a lot of good community journalism came out of that that hard work that everybody was doing.
Yeah, Bill, yeah. I appreciate that thought, too. And, you know, it's interesting, people like Bill, people who have worked in newspapers, there's even a big Facebook group for journalists or former journalists. It's like a therapy group. What's your plan B for people who are getting out of journalism? I mean, Tracy Griffith, you heard Meredith say she's 19. She's never been told to look at a newspaper. She just Googles. And that goes to Paul's point about if you don't get the clicks, you know, if the Google search doesn't come up with your story. Mm-hmm. But so what do you think about the future of journalism?
Well, I think it's in the hands of our youth, right? I mean, we really need
on the phones of our youth.
Right, exactly, sadly. We really need to kind of shape what's important to them, right, and have them recognize what's important to our success as a democracy, as Candy alluded to, right? It's about being able to sustain ourselves as a community, and without the sharing of that information, without journalists to do that. This isn't something you can outsource. This isn't something you can automate. Journalists have a job to do, and without them, we will sorely be lacking as a community.
Well, you have four people here in this room who care deeply about journalism and the news media in Vermont, so we could talk for hours, but we're going to let you all go to the next program. Tracy Griffith is associate professor at St. Michael's College in the Department of Media Studies, Journalism, and Digital Arts, and also a former Associated Press correspondent. Candace Page spent 30 years reporting and working for the Burlington Free Press. She's now a consulting editor at 7 Days. And Paul Heinz is a staff writer and political editor at 7 Days. Thanks very much to all three of you. I appreciate your insight.
Thanks, Jen.